issue number 14, right away, the very first thing we notice is a cameo.
Is it that obvious?
Yeah. At least that was the first thing that I noticed, is that we've got Kenny Powers sitting in the chair.
Well, yeah, okay. You know, where that came from for me was, you know, I love Danny McBride. He's a great, he's a hilarious actor. You know, I first saw him in, now in Pineapple Express. That was the first time I ever saw him, a movie mm-hmm. with him in it. But I really, you know, I love Kenny Powers. I mean, that's a great show, you know. But this whole scene, this whole opening scene, which I didn't have the script for at first. Like, it actually started on page 3, which is Laura Hodge running to the hall. I didn't get the beginning sequence until later. So I'd already drawn half the issue. You know, it actually takes place at the school first before I got this kind of flashback. But I don't know. He, you know, the mullet, you know, it's great. But I don't know. He just kind of had this look about him that sort of looked like Witchfinder to me. 1700s era, circa Witchfinder like type. So I just kind of cast him there, a reasonable facsimile, if his lawyers are listening. You know, in the role, and I don't know, it was fun.
Have you seen Your Highness as well?
I have not,
because that's a, you know, almost period related. Almost.
Right. Yeah, this is one of those movies that, outside of Natalie Portman, you know, looking kind of hot, I was like, well, I don't know if I want to see this.
So, you know, I think we've actually kind of sort of talked about this before, but when you cast somebody in a role,
mm-hmm.
Is it usually just a spur of the moment thing? Do you just, you know, you read about a character and say, okay, why not?
Yeah, sometimes. You know, and then there are those instances where Nick has a very specific look in mind. You know, there are some characters we introduce at the end of this arc that he had very specific directions on, which, you know, we'll talk about them later. But, you know, some of these kind of ancillary characters, whatever, that we meet in flashbacks or, you know, the faculty, whatever, you know, it just comes down to the fact that, you know, I don't want to just go with, like, a stock look, because I don't want everybody to look exactly the same. You know, I don't want people to think that I just kind of go back to a template or whatever. So I try to change things up, and, you know, and it just comes down to, like, I want to have fun with it. I want to do something that, you know, makes it fun for me, too. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thinking behind it, is to just cast somebody that'll make it interesting for me to draw.
So let's talk about the other big character in the scene. We've got, you know, we've got Mary. Is she based on anybody in particular?
No, she was, you know, I looked at reference pictures of girls in that time period and just wanted to keep her kind of plain, because that's really the overbearing look of women back then. I mean, we didn't really have Scarlett Johansson's back then, and you know, it's just a kind of an attempt to kind of keep with the times and kind of give a more general look to her. There's no attempt to make her look like anybody we've met before or any of the cast. It's more of an attempt to keep her sort of like a plain Jane.
Mm-hmm. And how about the setting for the cabin? I mean, cabins can generally be pretty plain in general, so I can't imagine you did too much research for that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, I did a diagram of how it's laid out and everything, so I know where all the rooms are. There was a description, knew that they're by a fireplace, but I really wanted it to look like a rustic old fireplace, so I did look up reference for that, just like an old stone fireplace built, you know, that's built into the wall or whatever. And, I wanted to keep it kind of run down, so it's all, you know, it's all wood. And, I mean, you got to keep with the times. You got to keep things accurate for the time period, which is always fun because we're jumping around all over the place. So it's a little difficult. But, I mean, I do, especially whenever we do jump time periods, I try to at least do some scenery references just so that it looks somewhat, you know, at least like a, an attempt was made to make it look accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And speaking of references, the crushing sequence, mm-hmm. is that based on anything that you had to look up, or
yeah, Nick sent me reference for that. That was he had to scour Google before he sent that to me. He was like, sent me like a really tiny image, and he was like, "This is the best I can find, man. Sorry." And yeah, it's I had actually never heard of this torch before, so I hopefully depicted it correct based on the little amount of reference I was able to get.
So as we move on, I like this sequence, and this was actually something that I had mildly got hung up on by mistake. You know, we have this scene of Lara running down to meet the other teachers, and there's the light in the hallway.
Right.
And I had assumed that this could mean something, that, you know, maybe mm-hmm. there's a crack in the wall there or something, or,
yeah,
you know, it's something ancient. But, you know, Nick kind of laughed at me. It was like, it's literally just a light in the hallway. That,
yeah.
I guess, did Alex just throw that in afterwards so that it wasn't completely
dark? Yeah, I mean, the way I looked at it is, when we go down into these catacombs in the school, I view the fact that they would probably need, like, security lights or whatever in order to see where the hell they're going, because there's some parts of it that have, you know, slots for torches or whatever, and then at other moments, it's like, well, there's nothing in here illuminating anything. I don't see how the hell they'd find the way, so... I drew in a little kind of security light thing there, and Alex made it shine. So my conception of it is that she's running, because if you notice the panel two, it's dark down mm-hmm. the steps, is that when she reaches a certain point that it kind of activates a sensor or whatever and turns on that light. So little techno gadgetry there, mm-hmm. not, you know, it's nothing that to affect the story or anything, but
right.
But sometimes a light is just a light.
Yeah, unless you're, you know, excessively over analytical like I am and have to make sense of everything. Like,
yeah.
That. But, you know, by the end of Morning Glories, that's going to be my one pet peeve. It's just like, you never explain the light.
Yeah.
So with these catacombs and with these things, you know, you have your layout of the school grounds.
Yes.
Is there any sort of interior map you try to keep to, or is it basically just like, you know what, there's probably a hall somewhere that has a stairs downward?
I have a kind of a map for issue 4, when Hunter gets the note at lunch and he has to wander around the catacombs to find Casey and Ike and Zoe. I did do kind of a brief little, you know, sort of diagram of where the hell everything was. So that I knew, okay, he turned right here, he went and left here, and straight ahead, whatever. For this, though, I kept it kind of freeform, because I figured there are a lot of little spots in the school where, you know, there's these kind of dungeon entrances. This one I just view is kind of like down a spiral staircase, not any reference to any place that we'd been before.
Mm-hmm. And... In the next sequence, we have the map that you mentioned.
That's right.
And that is your actual map.
That is my map that I have as a Photoshop file on my computer, so hopefully nothing will ever happen to my computer. I mean, I have it backed up, but, you know, and hopefully I never get hacked because, you know, somebody would have, like, the map in the school. Nick, you know, he wants to keep it kind of general. He's got some more... I guess, to reveal about the school. So it is covered up with files and papers and Ribs' coffee cup there and file folders so we don't see everything.
So with a scene like this, where it's just three people in a room talking,
yeah.
When it comes to blocking it out and setting it all up and everything, how does that work? Do you have a lot of specific instructions? Do you just move them around at your whim to keep things lively?
I try to keep to the script as close as possible because, like, when you read a comic, you know, you go left to right.
Mm-hmm.
So I, in terms of, like, the way Nick writes the dialogue, I try to keep everybody where their respective dialogue balloons are going to be, or at least leave enough space to where Johnny, our letterer, can make it all make sense or whatever. So that's why Laura goes and sits on that side of the table or whatever. And, I mean, and two... it worked out that good anyway because of the icy greeting that she gives Gribbs. You know, as a character, she wouldn't want to be anywhere near him, so she goes to like the complete opposite side of where he is. But yeah, it's talking head scenes. You know, I love hate them because I can draw them really fast, but to me, while I'm drawing them, they can get really boring. But it's easier with just two people. When you have three people, you know, or more, it gets to be a juggling act and making sure you keep continuity, keep track of everybody. You know, I want to make sure that if Laura sits down, she stays sitting down until I make a conscious decision to have her stand up and move around so that I don't accidentally draw her sitting back down in another panel. That's where the kind of the headaches come in, is like making sure I know where everybody is. So sometimes I'll just draw like a really quick little diagram. Okay, you know, here's Laura, here's Georgina, here's Mr. Gribbs, whatever. And it's like, just so I know where they are and where I can move them.
Mm-hmm. And with things like with Laura sitting on the table and, you know, Miss Darmount takes her glasses off and rubs them. Is that stuff that's usually in the script, or is that you...
Sometimes. It depends. I don't think Laura sitting on the desk was in the script. I don't know. I'll have to check. But I do know Nick wanted Ms. Darmount to clean her glasses. You know, it's just stuff like that that's like fun little kind of character moments to kind of break up the monotony of the fact that you're basically just, you know, having an exposition scene of people sitting around talking. You need to have them doing things. You know, people don't just stand still and talk. So, you know, have them move around, have them do stuff. You can. It's kind of harder with comics when you're doing like a live action series. You know, actors will do stuff like that on their own. They'll scratch their nose or, you know, rub their hair or whatever, or do whatever you tell them. But with comics, you kind of just kind of have to come up with that on your own.
So I know, you know, there's certainly certain story details that you don't know. But mm-hmm. but let's get your opinion on this stated for the record.
Okay.
With these three characters, with the three teachers that are most prominent.
Yeah.
What do you think of these guys? You know, they good, they bad. What are your thoughts on them?
You know, my earliest conception of Laura was, I think, everyone else's. You know, that she was kind of, you know, kids is or the secret ally to the kids or whatever. Whereas Gribbs and Darmount are definitely more malevolent. But I think what you'll discover is it's not as cut and dry as that with any of them. You might think, you know, somebody is malevolent when they may not actually be that way. There may be reasons behind their behavior that are just not yet revealed. And I'm trying to be as general as possible because we get really specific with Laura and Georgina in issue 20. And find out some pretty surprising things about the two of them, so, and their motivations. So, I think my general feeling in all three of them is that, you know, they're extremely interesting because there's so much about them that and their motivations that we haven't revealed yet.
So, you know, you wouldn't necessarily say good or bad for anybody.
No. I mean, there's too much gray area, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there any character that you'd probably put a stamp on, or no? You like to keep it open-ended?
Probably Nurse Nine. She's pretty sadistic. And I love drawing her because she is so sadistic. And it's always a treat to get a scene with her because... I don't know. It's like it kind of harkens back to the era of horror movies that Nick and I both kind of love and reference a lot. Just that kind of twisted evil character. So I view her definitely as you know, pretty upfront with being malevolent.
Mm-hmm. So with this upcoming scene with Zoe. Mm-hmm. As she deals with, you know, the picture in her locker and all of this stuff, there's a good deal of extras here.
Yeah.
Is there anybody to take note of here?
You mentioned the last time we talked were the Gossip Girls, and they are actually in this issue. They're in panel 3 of page 9.
There you go.
Yep, Zoe crumples up the picture, and then, oh, there's these girls whispering about her. Oh, they're talking about her. And then the one girl was like, got her nose up, like, she doesn't approve. So, so yeah, those two girls, I'm going to keep putting them in there until Nick gets tired of them and decides to kill them.
Well, you know, you would have almost imagined that those two girls in the bathroom as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't want it to be too obvious, like, that it's the same girls all the time. So I was like, well, I need to do some different people.
Right. Are any of the other people fans or anything like that? Or these are all just sort of generic kids thrown in there?
Just generic kids. I mean, like, you know, going back to panel 3 on page 9, I mean, there's that really kind of fat kid there. It's more of an opportunity to show that, it's so awful to say this, but like, that not everybody is thin and pretty at that school.
Right, yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah.
I mean, I can't help but assume that all of these, you know, there's the books in her locker and things like that, is that there's no real tricks to those?
No, I mean, you know, I'm trying to think, like, what would a high schooler have in their locker, what kind of books, and, you know, especially, like, at a prep school, so, you know, put an astronomy book in there, you know, there's a music book and a binder and literature, and, you know, it's just spitballing, trying to think, you know, what would they have in their locker.
Mm-hmm. I think at one point kind of guessed that maybe the astronomy cover was, like, a book that you had had or something like that.
No, just, I was like, well, let's see astronomy. Well, I'll just throw some planets on here. Yeah. And let me say this, too. You know, and I think it's kind of funny. We're at a prep school. And I don't know if this was a dictation in the early scripts. Because, I mean, it's been so long since we started. But I think it's funny that there's lockers. They're at a private school. Why would, you know, I don't know why there's lockers. But it's such a fundamental part of high school to have a locker. So, I mean, it's good that we have them there. And it's a good plot device, too, because, you know, having Zoe find that picture. I mean, if you didn't have lockers in the school, I mean, I don't know how the hell. I mean, I guess she could find it in her room or something, but you know, it's just such a fundamental part of school that, you know, it's good that we have them. But it was one of those things that after we'd been a few issues in, I thought about it. I'm like, wait, why do they have lockers?
Well, I went to a private school, and we had lockers. We didn't have – it wasn't like a – one that you stayed at, obviously.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I understand that there are private schools that have lockers, but I mean, I'm thinking, part of me is thinking it's sort of like in a university type setting where, you know, you just have a dorm, so I figured, you know, you would keep all your stuff in the dorm, but, you know.
You know, come to think of it, the college I went to, they did have lockers there.
Wow, interesting.
Not in every building. But there were lockers, and I think the deal was it was like a first come first serve thing.
Oh, I see.
I mean, that's completely tangential.
Yes, so, I know people are probably like just brimming with excitement. Wow, they're talking about lockers.
And it, you know, I do believe last time we saw Lars' office, we had the same decorations, right? None of that has changed.
Yes, none of that has changed. I had to keep going back to that page to make sure I got every one of them, you know, just keeping her kind of hippie-ish. You know, what I love are the, at the end of page 14, there on the left side of the panel, there's like two drawings. There's like a dude, there's really thin drawings, just a dude holding beers, and there's like a bottle of wine. I don't know. I just think that's fun. It's something that because I've been to Europe a few times and I've seen stuff like that for sale, like in souvenir shops, just kind of weird sort of European style decorations. So that's why that's there. And there's, other than I think the original direction for Laura having a Bonnaroo poster, there's no rhyme or reason to any of those posters.
So one thing I forgot to mention, and I'll mention it now, but I will say that the Morning Glory kids have the cleanest bathroom stall walls I've ever seen in any high school.
Yeah.
Like, you would almost imagine that, you know, maybe they would write, like, don't trust so-and-so.
Oh, I know, right? That's funny, because it sort of kind of comes from Nick. One of the issues, I think it was issue 5, is one where Gribbs is at the beginning of the issue, and he's going over his papers and stuff. I had a desk with some words scrawled onto it. And that was one thing Nick came back to saying, nah, I need to take that off. This isn't that kind of school. So I'm like, oh, okay, well. So yeah, this isn't kind of school. Yeah.
The kids are good here.
Yeah. Or they get severely reprimanded if they, you know, do deface property.
Right. That's why you get drowned.
Yes. Exactly.
Or what? He breaks the kid's neck in issue 5, right? He strangles him.
Strangles him to death. That's right.
So this this issue is particularly great because, you know, when we get back to the big crowd scene, mm-hmm. in terms of cameos and introducing new characters, the best one appears in this issue.
Best one ever.
Ever, yeah. He is on what page is this? Page 22.
That's right.
And he is he's a dapper looking young man. So where did you get the inspiration for such a fine looking gentleman?
Well, I had this guy who kept asking for a cameo, and I was like, well, dude, you've got this beard. How am I going to put you in the book? I mean, this is like, you know, like I just told you, like you don't have kids scrawling on desks or writing on bathroom walls. So they're pretty strict about stuff. So I imagine they're pretty strict about dress code as well. So none of the students have any kind of facial hair whatsoever. So I was like, you know, I can't have you be a student. So, which obviously, I'm going to stop being coy, it's you. you know, you kept asking for a cameo, and I'm like, well, we have this teacher that shows up, and it was just in the script written, you know, just male teacher. I was like, okay, here we go, here's Matt's part. I like the kind of semi-casual suit you got on there. You got the jacket, but you don't wear the tie, and you got the patches pads on the jacket. Yep. Yeah, I know, I was like, you know, because, I mean, I've drawn so much clothing in this book. I mean, my God, I've drawn vests and ties and shirts and jackets, and like I need to do something to change it up. So, and I figure, you know, with that beard, you look like you kind of buck the system a little bit. So yeah, that's why you've got the nice fancy elbow patches there.
If anyone was going to come in and dress nicely, but still dumb it down and kind of be a slacker, that would be me.
Nice.
I just got to come back now and continue teaching the kids. And, I suggested it to Nick, but if Dagny ever needs a love interest, you've got a great character for it right here.
Yeah. Well, you're pretty much a lot younger than her.
That's all right.
At this point.
love knows no age boundaries.
No, that's true.
Aside from him, are there any other cameos hidden here?
I think the readers from the last issue that I put in, I think they may be in these scenes again. I think they're on page 19 between Hunter and Jun. The girl there standing between them is one of the readers. But these are mostly kind of just generic faces. I try to diversify the cast a little bit. I mean, tried to throw in a few kind of Indian people. It's always, you know, sometimes I have to tell Alex, you know, okay, this person is this particular race because, you know, he colors. I mean, I throw a lot at him. I mean, you can see in these pages. I mean, there's so much crowd detail and so many people. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, he just kind of just goes with it. And somebody that I saw is a particular race or look or whatever, like he'll color it something different, and it's, you know, it's entirely my fault for not, you know, giving him a specific direction. So I try to give him direction about that sometimes.
So one of the things I was sort of curious about is, you know, we learned this later in issue number 18, mm-hmm. but you know, you've got Jun, he's like looking around here, he seems really distracted.
Yeah.
And we learn later that he saw, you know, Guillaume from his childhood.
Correct.
Is he in the crowd here? Because for the life of me, I can't find him.
No, he is not. He was not introduced to me as a character until issue 18. So I didn't know. I had no idea what he looked like at that point. So yeah, he's not in the crowd. So okay. don't try playing Where's Waldo with him.
So. You know, Zoe is a big star of this particular issue.
Yes.
You know, she goes a little bit crazy, to say the least. But you know, she's kind of running the gauntlet in terms of expressions and,
yeah.
and her, you know, she starts off the issue as the usual kind of, you know, sassy gal, and then she gets really sad, and then she gets really sinister on top of angry and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to, you know, capture these various different moods of, like, the most moody person in the book, do you have any particular tricks or anything to kind of to nail her looks down?
Well, yeah, she really is a big canvas here in this issue, the gamut of emotions. And it's so much fun. You know, from her kind of stoic kind of swagger, you know, in the early parts of the issue, which is something I love about the character. I love that she just kind of, she has, especially like the top panel, page 8, like just the kind of cold expression on her face. That's always like fun for me to draw. But, you know, her, drawing her crying and everything, that's, crying is tough, man. I mean,
is it?
And I imagine that's tough for actors too. You know, it's like, you know, I did a play once way back in the day when
what?
I was in college. Yeah, I was in a Neil Simon play at college, and it was called God's Favorite, which is basically just a retelling of the Book of Job in sort of like a semi-modern setting. Anyway, I played this character, coincidentally enough, named David. And there was a scene at the end where I had to get really emotional and cry. And, like, I had the hardest time with that. Like, the director and I, we fought tooth and nail. I was like, I just couldn't do it. I could not figure out how to find that kind of emotional, you know, response, you know, to project it accurately. And then, but, you know, the rest of the role I did pretty good in. But I always knew every time we got to that particular point of the play at the end where I had to cry and get emotional that I was like, I just can't. I'm not doing this. I'm not pulling this off. But, you know, and this is going to sound like kind of weird, but for the scene of Zoe crying and everything, and in any point, whenever, you know, we have girls crying, because we seem to have a lot of that lately. We have a lot of girls. I know Casey kind of gets really emotional. She turns into a wet rag in her issue 16. But, you know, you just really, you have to think back to things in your life that were emotionally hard for you, and now I can summon up the tears if I need a reference. Like, you know, I mean, it's like, I don't know, I can take a photo of myself and then I can get semi choked up, or I can get all verklempt, you know, and get a good reference pick, and then I'm off and going. I just, like, why didn't I figure this out back when I was doing this play? But, you know, that's a whole other story. But yeah, and then, you know, to go from the crying to her just being deliciously evil to Hunter. I mean, that was like
right.
one of my favorite sequences of the book is Hunter seeing Zoe and just that look when they meet, their eyes meet on page 19, and it's like, oh shit. And you don't know, it's, I, you know, I think back to, and this sounds really unfair, to girls I knew in college. There was one girl in particular, her name was Robin. She was a good friend, great friend, but she had a vicious streak to her. And, you know, I do kind of think of her when Zoe's being mean. I think about how she acted, you know, the way her body language was and everything. And, it's, you know, it goes back to that. It's like, you know, and in this girl, it's kind of fair to say, really she was kind of a damaged girl. I mean, you meet all kinds of people in college, and she was one of those. No, I'm not saying she was mentally unstable or anything, but, you know, everybody has, you know, their issues or whatever. So, you know, you go to like a scene on page 24 where Zoe's really giving it to Hunter, and he just looks like he's about to just collapse into like a little puddle or whatever. You know, that goes back to, you know, seeing this girl that I knew and how she would get mad and you wanted to stay out of her way. So it all comes down to drawing from real life, and that's the only way you can kind of get an effective expression on a character, I think.
So, you know, do you this is probably a weird question, but do you find Zoe at all relatable?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are some things that, you know, I identify with, and it really took, you know, like, ones we turned the focus more on her, you know, like with her flashback issues, you know, getting some more insight into her. I think, you know, the next issue, one where she and Hunter have that long talk, that makes me sympathize a little bit more with her and understand more where she's coming from. Because I've seen the gamut of reactions for her. You know, people love her or they just really, really hate her. And for the ones that hate her, I always wonder if they see somebody that they knew. Because, you know, like I said, I kind of project people that I knew into her. But I'm wondering if they see somebody that they knew that hurt them in her, and that's maybe why they're having such a strong reaction to her.
Right.
If so, I mean, I'm doing a really good job. But, you know, I always worried about Nick and I making her too mean and unrelatable, but I don't think she is unrelatable. I think, you know, she definitely has, there's more to her story, obviously, but, you know, she has things about her that she's not proud of and that she's dealing with, and her coping mechanism is the way she acts. And so that's what I always view her behavior is. I mean, she does have kind of sociopathic tendencies, but I think there's redeemable aspects in her, to be honest.
So, in an upcoming sequence, we, you know, after her big, you know, this stuff is my stuff routine, you know, we get this sequence where it flashes between the two time periods.
Yeah.
You know, there's the part set in the Salem witch trial era, and then there's the part back in the regular time. So, you know, when flashing between the two,
yes,
is there any kind, you know, how specific were the directions for these? How much is you just kind of improvising, if any?
Well, you know, they were pretty loose, but the scenes that flash back, it's a talking head sequence, and
right,
it's just Danny McBride and the girl. So, I didn't really draw a lot of backgrounds in those just because they're all talky stuff. So, you know, I established it at the first start of the flashbacks, you know, that they're still back in that cabin and that they're by the fire. But then I just started dropping out the background because it's just, it's all talky stuff. And the emphasis right there isn't the art or the setting. It's what they're saying. So you need to pay more attention to what they're saying. I don't want to distract from that. My one regret about this sequence is that I don't have any of the kids running in the wood run. Like Nick's direction was, you know, they're looking at the maps and they're starting out in the forest or whatever. But I mean, it's called wood run and I don't have a single character running. And I feel kind of bad about that, but,
well, not yet anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. But I kind of wish that, you know, at least, the bottom of page 26 or whatever, when you see the feet, that they'd been running instead of walking. But hey, you know, it is what it is.
So when you're differentiating between like all black backgrounds,
yeah,
and all white backgrounds,
yeah,
would I can assume that's put in for Alex?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Alex, you know, he does, he won't typically leave a background white. He'll do something there to give it some pop. So I know, in those cases, you know, I can just, you know, all right, that's fine. He'll figure out what to do. You know, like a sequence, like page 30, where Dermot's freaking out. I didn't want to have the background there because the emphasis needs to be on Dermot and the fact that she's losing it. She's freaking out. She's losing the control of everything. And then, you know, once that's over, then you can jump in and show where she is. And then you jump to the last panel. And that was fun because all the direction was just, you know, Gribbs yells at her from off camera. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I thought it was fun to put her off center to kind of give the shot an uneasiness that you're not, you know, that for one, she's like, oh shit, I'm caught. And blacking it all out, you know, just so that, you know, there's nothing else for her to kind of like hide into. It's just blackness, you know. So those are the kind of artsy fartsy explanations, I guess, of that.
Right. But is, you know, when you switch from between dark and light, like when they change where they are.
Yeah.
Is there any sort of, the only major difference I can see between the two panels when you get that page, mm-hmm. on page 27 is that Zoe's eyes move.
Yeah.
Is there anything that changes at all from you with what you're doing now between when it's light time and night time?
Well, on page 27, what I did do was her hair is moving in panel 2 because she's walking and then she stops. So it's like in panel 4, it's like at the last part of stopping and then the lights go out. So I took the majority of the highlights out of her hair and then made it dark and told Alex, you know, that this one you need to switch the tones. You know, one's daylight, one's completely dark. Hunter and John didn't change. I think that's pretty stupid. I really should have had them move a little bit. But that's a case of where I'm trying to pull a lock and key, which Gabriel does so effectively. You know, like I said, you know, holding a camera somewhere, but the characters move, but the background and everything stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one thing that I'm still trying to do, but I can't do it quite as good as he does.
Well, you know, not for nothing. I think the sort of thing that it's only Zoe that moves.
Yeah.
Considering that she's such a huge part of this story arc anyway, that it's only her that's moving really kind of highlights that idea that we need to be watching her. So that's the, you know, you can save that one for next time somebody asks about why the other two don't move. But I mean, outside of that, for like the rest of the sequence, there's no major change between how you're handling it?
No, not at all.
Okay. And we should also note, you know, somebody actually asked about this in the questions,
mm-hmm.
but Pamela does appear here.
Yeah.
In page 29.
That's correct.
Top panel. And I love that she's with these two huge beefy dudes.
Yeah. That was my choice because like I wanted a contrast between side. I think Nick put in there, Pamela walks off into the forest with two big dudes. And you know, I could have gone either way with that. I could have gone obese or I could have gone over the muscular. But I figured Pamela would hang out with the jocks and the muscular dudes. So it's fun to draw Pamela. I haven't drawn her since. I miss Pamela. I hope she comes back.
She should. She's one of those characters, I think, that like freak people out, but in
she's great.
In a good way.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned this in the study hall, but when Gribbs is yelling at Darren, the painting on the wall is the crossing of the River Styx.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't in the script, and that was just me because as I said before, I love Virgil's Dante or whatever, the Dante's Inferno.
Right.
That just I did throw that in there to kind of, you know, throw a wrench into people, like for them to look at it and be like, okay, what does this mean? I'm sorry. I apologize for that. That may have been a little mean, but that's more of just, if there's any statement to that, it's my saying that school is hell. No, not like literally, like they're actually dead and they're in hell. But no, I'm just saying like school is hell, like in general.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, that they've coming to the school, they've crossed the proverbial River Styx into this hell, which is, pretty much, it is hell. I mean, drowning students, cults, and all kinds of crap. So, yeah.
I mean, everybody always... I don't know many people who are overly fond of their high school time.
Yeah, exactly.
That was very much, you know... Just being that age in general is hell, no matter what school you're at, so...
Yeah, definitely.
So here's something. I feel like this might be a silly question, but I've always kind of wondered it.
Okay.
Drawing rain... And drawing rain on characters.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the trick to doing that? And especially to make it look like the rain bounces off of them.
Yeah, let me tell you, I was so nervous about that when I saw that in the script, because I'd never drawn rain before, mm-hmm. ever. And I quickly, frantically ran to my comic shelf. I'm like, how does everybody else draw rain? And, like, the one that stuck out to me that I remembered because I had read it somewhat recently was Naoki Urasawa's Pluto, the manga, because like the whole first volume, there's like a kind of an iconic sequence that takes place in a rain shower. So I looked at that and I was like, all right, I see this. And I see that he has like these lines, but he has some kind of disintegrating a little bit. So it looks like they're losing strength as they fall or whatever. So what it ended up being was a multi-step process. So if you've seen the original ink pages for these, the actual vertical lines of rain, they're not on there. I didn't draw those traditionally. What I did draw was the rain splashing off of them and falling on them, like dripping and stuff. And, you know, because I would look at films, you know, look at freaking, I don't know why this one automatically sprang to mind, but I thought of, freaking episode 2, the sequence on the water planet where they're fighting outside and it's a rainstorm and just, you know, paying attention to how rain hits people and bounces off and stuff. And so what I would do is draw that traditionally or whatever, draw the splashing and the rain hitting off, and then digitally go in with Photoshop and the pen tool and just make vertical lines and stroke those lines, set them to be stroked to pen pressure so that they kind of get like a thin, then they go start out thin, then go fat, then go back to thin, and just, you know, move that line across and move it up and down. And yeah, because rain doesn't fall uniformly. It falls, you know, at different speeds and stuff. So try to move things around. So some of it's, you know, as you see the shot, some of it is just reaching the frame. Some of it's out of the frame. Some of it's in the middle of the frame. So, yeah, it was one of those things I just kind of had to learn on the fly, really.
Can I just say that it sounds pretty funny when you say you have to stroke that line?
Yeah, I know. It probably does.
So, between, all the trees and the rain, what do you think you got sick of more?
Trees. Yeah. I'll draw rain, you know, give me rain every day. I don't care, that's fine. But, because, even as I'm talking to you right now, man, I'm drawing trees. Lots and lots of trees. And I know Alex is probably like, oh, God, more trees. Yeah. But, you know, it serves the story, and I'm good with that. But, you know, it's one of those things sometimes, you know, just, that comes with the job. There are things that are like, I got to do what again?
So as we close the door on this issue, is there anything big that we missed? Any major secrets or Easter eggs or tricks of the trade?
No, because I mentioned the painting. Well, there is another... what am I trying to say? Oh, there's another reader there at the end of the issue. One of the security guards, panel 2 on the right, is one of the readers. He actually was the one standing with Dagny in the last issue. So there's that guy, and we talked about everything else.
Has I remember we said this in the last arc. The guy that played Mickey on Doctor Who. He was a fan. Did he ever end up coming back? Because he was a security guard.
Yeah, I don't have the colored page on me, so I can't tell you for sure. But I did draw him there on page 30, panel 3. He's to the right of Ms. Darimont, on her right. That's supposed to be the guy. I don't know if... like I said, I'm looking at the black and white page, so... yeah, that guy, I'd like to bring him back, just because I thought he was a pretty severe-looking security guard.
Right.
So, yeah.